I had different roles in each of them, almost none in the last one. And so let me just say a little bit about each of them, and then we'll have Sasha show you the first one. The first model is a model, when I first heard about these things, I'd kind of never had one of my own, so I bought one, a sort of CFO-style approach to things. So you get it up close and look it over, see what you thought. It was, these models are sort of a little bit like farming, where you can grow different stuff, but sometimes you use the same tools. So maybe you have a plow running all the way through, but some different crops. This was for a very specific purpose, to understand a single regulatory change that could be written in a couple of sentences, which was one of many parameters in the stock market. And it was undertaken for the specific purpose of seeing whether that would be a wise or foolish thing to do. It showed that it would be a foolish thing to do, and we did it anyway. So that's a very practical kind of application. Most of that work was done by Sasha and Vince Darley. They also have written a book about it that Sasha will tell you how to get a hold of. It's probably the one of the better documented of the three. The other one that's quite well documented is the last one, which you're going to see from Sam. The middle model, Particon, was built for an entirely different purpose. It was built to explore what we could learn from it theoretically about economics. And so these purposes branch extremely rapidly in almost orthogonal directions. Specific decision-making model, general theoretic model. I'll just tell you, that model was primarily driven by Jim and Bruce and Zoe. It was interesting. I'd never heard before you talked about Collins, but when we started, Stu had some role in the Particon model, so we had a theoretical biologist. As luck would have it, several years into the drill, we ended up with the fisheries biologist, a guy named Jim Anderson, who did the kind of work you were talking about for Canada. He was probably the leading guy at the University of Washington for how to think about salmon in the Columbia River. He grew interested in the timescale impacts of how fish explore the adjacent possible when they are foraging for food, and he actually ended up with some stuff that Jim and Bruce have been thinking about adding to the Particon model of the economy. He would have been here with us, but he got sidetracked because it turned out the government thought this might also be helpful technology for thinking about how terrorists behave, and he was given a big grant to apply fish foraging to terrorist behavior. So just amazing how many of these dots come together. So you'll see the Particon model, which is an extremely different approach to things. Jim and Bruce have also built a number of the kind of models that Sasha built. For example, they built the biggest, I think, in the private sector transportation agent-based model for a specific purpose of predicting travel behavior when a single variable in the travel equation was moved back and forth. And that model was presciently predictive. So the people that say you can't predict things with agent-based models are having some different experience than mine. But if you want to use them for predicting, you better have a narrow question in mind that you really want to answer, and not trying to be answering, you know, everything all at once. And then finally, the third model, Sam's model, which I'm just totally amped about and had, you know, absolutely nothing to do with, really, except just watch it a little bit of how that sausage got built and get excited about it, came from the connection when we brought the Particon model to Perimeter, when we got to know Eric and Pia and started to see some of the physics arithmetic applied to the agent modeling technique. So this is show and tell time, And I just remind you to begin with that Sasha first, it was a I'd call it a business-based app, make a decision on a specific thing model, then we have theory, and then we have theory, and the fact that the two guys in the middle are doing theory today doesn't mean they can't do the other. They just can only do one or the other at a time. So with that, Sasha, you want to tell them? Please. Eric, you have a magic touch. Last time you touched it, you fixed it. Okay, I'm going to give this microphone to Sasha.
I actually changed.
If you put it up on the desk, Sasha, maybe. Do you have a different cord?
Just put a little lift underneath and the cord will...
I just wanted to make one of
the ways. You need a pen or something underneath the thing? There's a pen
to the side. Zoe needs to make a point.
Make your point.
Mike keeps telling you that policymakers ignored, that the SEC ignored the results from Sasha's model. And I just wanted to give you a flavor from my brief experience in the public policy setting. There's sort of three types of policymakers and their attitude towards research. One is that they're looking for confirming evidence. So they're looking at research to confirm a policy position they have. The other is that they're looking for disconfirming evidence. So they have a policy position and they're willing to take evidence of somebody against their policy position. And then there's the third that are open-minded, that are essentially haven't formed a position yet and are open to research to inform the position they might want to take. There aren't a whole lot of the third around. He ran into people who had made up, policymakers who had made up their mind, and he was bringing them disconfirming evidence. And of course, they're not particularly interested in disconfirming evidence. So if we want to have influence on policymakers, we have to figure out sort of what we have, find the open-minded ones. If we already have evidence that we still want to bring and there aren't open-minded ones, we have to figure out who wants disconfirming, if we can bring it or confirm it. So you have to figure out who your policymakers are and what you're bringing to them. That's all I'd like to say.
Thank you, Zavanna, and thank you, Mike, for introduction. So I will be talking about our NASDAQ modeling project, and it actually was done together with a number of people, in particular Vince Darley and other people at Bayer Group or contributing. And Mike was instrumental in this project happening. So the problem NASDAQ was having back in 1998 is that it was forced effectively to go to decimals, but it was unclear how doing that would affect the market dynamics and market behavior. So, and also a question there, and that was one of the questions I first was puzzled about, is why should it have any effect? And so one of the reasons for building the model is to build this causal structure in which one can investigate what effects could be and what would be the mechanism of such effects. And so, obviously, one of the possibilities here is through market maker and investors' changes. But it's also possible that some of the infrastructure may change or may have to change as a result of the change in rules. So that's another mechanism for the market effect. And also, given if there are any changes to the market, so our first question is, of course, how that would affect the market behavior in general, but also what other possible effects can occur later on, not necessarily immediately, but, for example, would market structure change? So our goals, the goals of this project were to investigate the effects of possible policy changes and specifically evaluate the the effect of the change in tick size. But also, slightly more broadly, also to be able to convince ourselves that the model doing the right thing, evaluate in general effects of market rules and structures on market dynamics and strategies, and also demonstrate that what we have in our market, the individual behaviors and also market behaviors are...
What does parasitism mean in this context?
Actually, I will reach it later. Yes, I have a special slide. Thank you for the question. But it's a specific strategy which actually affects the results quite significantly. Oh.
I mean, ticks are parasites.
I did say, guess I've learned, put a historical...
Tick size, I get it.
Wall Street's famous for adjectives. Many of them mean nothing. For example, hedge fund has nothing really to do with hedging. It doesn't mean it's what these guys do. It means it sounds good and you know, it's a good kind of packaging. When the tick size parameters came down from eighths to sixteenths, which was a favorite thing for, among others, Bernie Madoff back in his heyday, the NASDAQ market began to experience a problem with what we called SOES bandits. SOES was a small order execution system. And you know, they were basically trading very rapidly without, you know, much weighting towards the long only value orientation. And there was a big debate about it. Had the SOES bandits not populated the ecosystem as fully as they did, there probably would have been much less pressure for this next move to decimalization. Since then, today, like last month and for the last 2 years, the topic of quote unquote toxic trading and predatory trading has become a huge thing on Wall Street. You can attend entire conferences where the whole topic is toxic trading. One of the guys that was somewhat associated with this model is a guy named Fred Federspiel, who is now CEO of a company that Dome works with now part of the time, which essentially, to be brief, provides algorithmic prophylaxis for the long-only desks, so that guys trading big blocks and for the long term can have some way to do that without being predated by the toxic trading. So the adjective does not have a precise meaning. It had just started to be used in the etymology at this particular period in history, and you can use the word on Wall Street today, and everybody on the street knows what you're talking about. And it's an issue of many, many, many conferences and efforts to try to figure out what to do about it.
Thank you. So this is how one can look at the problem. So on the top, we have a rule change. Now, so the question is, why this rule change could or should affect the market? What could be possibly the mechanism for it? And one of the possibilities to consider is that, well, about the only possibility to consider is, given that the market is composed of market participants and market rules and infrastructures, is how this rule change would actually affect one of those boxes. For example, that it would affect individual investors, market investors, maybe professional traders, and but it also would affect, maybe not necessarily immediately and not necessarily directly, but it would also affect the market institutions and market dynamics as well. So that's the question, and that's also a motivation for how we represented the problem and how we approached it using agent-based modeling, because here we explicitly say that those are the entities through which the change can propagate into the market. So that means that we want to understand how those entities will behave, and also how the interaction and behaviors would then create or affect the overall market dynamic. So in order to build such a model, those are, and this is a very high level overview. If there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them, or we can talk later. So we constructed the following things. We created the agents, market makers, and investors. And we simulated the market infrastructure and rules. And under that, I mean, for example, how to unite the orders, how the investors actually execute the orders, how market makers change their quotes, et cetera. And the last step, but not least for sure, is we calibrated it to the real data. And that actually happened in a number of steps. We started initially with more or less anecdotal calibration, just simply by talking to NASDAQ people, to actual market makers, to understand what they're doing and using it there, up to the quantitative calibration, where we took actual things which happened to the market and mapped them into our strategies. And so the goal of this calibration exercise is to ensure that first, the overall market dynamics under, say, initial conditions is similar to what we have in the real world, but also that the behaviors of individual entities, individual agents in our simulation, market makers and investors, are also similar. And one of the other things we did is also to design the whole simulation so that it looked more or less like what the NASDAQ Level 2 system, trading system, looked at that time, because we also added this capability for humans to interact with the system.
Yeah, this is like it's a very standard thing in the business side of agent modeling where you're trying to make a specific prediction. This is just a standard part of the toolbox. The great thing about this is you can look at history and, you know, make a few changes that happened that, you know, without the model knowing about it. And if it predicts what happened when you change those things the way they changed before you told them you were going to do it, then when you go forward into the future, you've narrowed the problem to, well, how is it going to react to the thing you're going to change that it hasn't seen before? But at least, you know, it's not perfect, but at least at that point you're fairly comfortable that it's working right mechanically. So it's sort of like getting your car tuned up before you go on a road trip.
And here I will detour for a few philosophical observations. And so one of the things which actually was not really obvious initially, but once you think of the world as an agent-based system, just effectively all practically tautologically and almost by definition, because we are the entities which create world dynamics, market stock dynamics, crashes, bubbles, and everything else in between. Of course, it's done by these mechanisms and institutions provided otherwise, but we are the main drivers of these dynamics. So there isn't really a question for me that such a representation has a descriptive power. That's given. But the question is whether such a representation has a predictive power. And when it has such a power, what's needed to be done in order to achieve it? So, in particular, what would be the theoretical reasons for agent-based modeling to work? And I don't really have ready-made answers for those questions. What I will do is I will talk about our practical implementation of a specific problem in which we achieved a degree of predictability. And one of the crucial differences for me between this the more standard approaches in economics, like normative approaches, and what we do here is that we are not really trying to model the outcomes. We do not try to say that there is a steady state or there is an equilibrium and this is how you should behave in order to get there. Instead, we model the processes which lead from one state to another. And neither beginning nor end state might be, or maybe should be, an equilibrium. But we try to understand if the mechanisms which lead us from one state to another. And interestingly enough, that also leads to emergent behaviors in the simulation and also in the real world. Sometimes those emergent behaviors are called unintended consequences. I guess that's a subset of emergent behaviors. And interesting thing about agent-based simulations is that when you start with the simulation, you actually look for those unexpected things you did not expect. So you might end up invalidating your initial model, but you build a better model as a result of it, as a result of discovering things like that. So now I'm going to go back to talk in slightly more detail about the simulation. So our two types of agents in the simulation are market makers and investors. And they are, well, by definition, autonomous agents. And we have actually a fairly wide variety of strategies employed by those agents. So they could be, initially when we started working on this problem, we started maybe with 8 market makers. And so some of them were extremely simple. And so they could use a very simple rule that if people are buying from me, I will increase the price at which I will offer it to them and such. And many of those rules were initially derived with in conversations with people from on NASDAQ, with people on Wall Street, like actual market makers. But then we also added various degrees of sophistication to those strategies. For example, we parameterized and quantified to a large degree some of them, and so allowed to, for example, our market makers to do some analysis of the market they're in, or even we added learning strategies, and also different strategies using different can have different access to information, and also they may just choose to use more or less information depending on how they use it.
Did you try to calibrate those individual strategies?
Yes, we have. I actually have a slide or two on that.
Let me give you some color here, because it was hard to do when we initially started. Everybody thought we wouldn't be able to do it because we had to get NDAs from every firm. Everybody thought their strategies were proprietary and super fabulous and secret and gave them a huge competitive edge over everybody else. We went through this immense drill. You know, we had to have lawyers and everything else to make sure everybody's intellectual rights were protected. We had to have rules about what we could and couldn't show so that nobody would be competitively disadvantaged. And at the end of the day, I've forgotten. When you know, you pop, the way you do this is you go, okay, there's 10 strategies out there, and this many guys do this one, these do this, do this, and make it, make your agent, amount of agents for each strategy, you know, map in. And the things tended to lie on a power loss, so a handful of them was most of it. You don't get them all, but a handful of strategies covered most of it. And this was back in 98 when about algorithmic trading.
Yeah. When you say covered most of it, most of what? Most of the trading?
I'm saying when you map your, if it's a situation where there's a distribution of strategies, it tends to simplify agentizing things that you might have otherwise thought were very complex. And I was just going to say, if you go to the pipeline example, which is a modern example today, it's just released a product called an algorithm switching engine as part of the technology they use to kind of construct a virtual block for these long-only traders. They had a similar problem, but this time they were dealing with algorithms instead of people, and there was a similar result. You could cover a huge amount of the situation with a lot fewer algorithms than you might have initially thought when you start with, I don't know how many algorithms do you think there are out there now? So
just think,
wild guess, how many execution, individual algorithms, execution algorithms, would you guess there are if you took a wild guess?
Oh, execution algorithms.
Yeah.
I don't know, 50, 100, I don't know.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is out of 50 or 100, it turns out if you actually, you know, get into the market data and look at what's being used, you know, if you can agentize 6, you're covering 98% of the activity. And, you know, at some point, you know, as a practical matter, you just say, okay, I'm going to see what happens with this. And I understand, you know, in this outline tail, there could be the sleeping black swan event. But I can learn a lot about the market maker. So it's not, you know, it's not perfect. You make some practical shortcuts to get aimed at this single decision that you're trying to make. But the experience here with people and the experience this year with algorithms in terms of the distribution was quite similar.
I think you get the 100 down to the 6, either because some of them are huge, the rest are really small, or because it turns out that 94 of the, or whatever it is, of the 100 are actually doing more or less
the same thing.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Which is it? It's
when you taxonomize them that there's a whole bunch of things that are essentially the same that were arrived at from a different route. And 6 months ago or so, I had the privilege of being at Yale and talking about this with Martin Shubik, and he'd actually done some studies. He had sort of come to a similar conclusion by a much different path. So this works great if there's a distribution. If there isn't a distribution, like if it's Knightian, then this is a much harder problem.
Do you think your experience studying these market makers is a good example showing that people often succeed in business and they don't actually know why they're succeeding? I mean, these people thought they had proprietary special algorithms, and in fact, maybe everybody else was using very similar algorithms.
I didn't have to study a market maker to figure that out. I had succeeded, and I had no earthly idea most of the time how I was doing it or why.
The same thing is happening in car markets, but there are actually companies that are offering to provide strategy development, shadow settlements and bidding strategies. So there's conferences all over the place on how you should form your bidding strategies. Well, of course, this is coordinating people on a smaller set, I think. And when we look at the data in MISO, in my region, Midwest, the number of strategies actually being used for bidding and offering into power markets is actually quite tiny. People are very risk averse, actually. They're not doing all that much.
I guess it's obvious to someone who's been in business, but I had in mind some idealized economist who really believes in efficient markets and rational expectations. And if you demonstrate that individual actors don't even know their own business, they don't actually even understand what their competitors are doing in the industry.
But they don't.
I think that's the truth.
Why are you asking me what I'm doing? They're telling me when I go out to dinner with these guys, they say, why are you asking me what I'm doing? I want to find out what your agent's doing, because I don't know what the hell I'm doing.
Please, play back
here. Yeah, so I just wanted to raise a theoretical question before you go on, which is from a biological point of view, my understanding is that if you have too few strategies and too few niches in an ecosystem, you have a lot of instability. You're very fragile to external events, to not be able to recover from external events. And so a possible hypothesis is that what you discovered, it wasn't the object of either exercise, but maybe there are dynamics which narrow the range of successful strategies, and maybe that leads to instabilities, to bubbles, to crashes.
Well, it's it's dynamic. So if you stop and take this snapshot, out of the 100 typical execution algorithms, there may have been 3 or 4 or 5 that were kind of aiming in the same point. At the point you took the snapshot, you say, I can simplify this a little bit and summarize it in. Now we'll go ahead from here. And if you did it a year later, you'd probably have a different deal.
5 minutes more.
But that wasn't Sasha's fault that Mike is explaining what Sasha's doing. Come on. That's my fault. Give Sasha. I told you we'd use the short slide
version.
Why don't
you keep talking?
Sasha, you don't let him go.
I thought you started with me.
You did. It's been about half an hour. Do you want to take, 5, 10 minutes?
Maybe more like 10 minutes, please.
Okay, and then I'll have a short discussion.
Give us the hardcore stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. I'd like to find out what the model is.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd like to hear something about the model. I'm not interested in discussion.
We're flexible today, yeah. so if Sam doesn't mind, we might not be bumping Sam to the afternoon. We'll bump Sam.
We've got plenty of time.
We have to talk as fast as Mark.
Well, I don't know if you can do that.
Go ahead.
Come on. Okay, so this is a very brief description of the market. So our agents trade in a single stock. And market makers mean markets in the stock, what they do is offer bids and asks, or bids and offers, to the public. Our investors have a target price, which they think may be a good estimate of where the price is going for the security. And this price can follow, let's say, standard log normal walk. We tried different distributions. Also Poisson distribution jumps at a number of other things. So investors receive, when they make decisions, they receive some noisy information about this target value. And they all receive information about the same target value, but there is a noise added to it. So none of them really knows it for sure. In aggregate, they know it fairly well, but the market is the thing which actually aggregates the impressions and which allows that target price to be discovered. And investors decide whether to trade by, for example, they they could use different strategies. They could compare the target price with actual price today, and they see, for example, the difference is large, then they could trade depending on that difference. Or they could do just use market trends and completely disregard fundamental information. That depends on the strategy they're using. Or they could even do some more technical trading. We have some learning in our strategies, which I'll talk about later. So market makers receive those orders generated by investors, and then they execute them. But what they also, the main goal is actually to execute those orders profitably, and they do that by adjusting their quotes.
This could be a single, yes? Distinction between the first and the last category, the market agent versus the market maker?
Market agents is a term for both market makers and investors. This is an overloaded slide. It covers two things. It covers the parasitic strategies, but it also covers the interaction between market makers and investors. So the red line is this target price about which investors receive information, noisy one. The blue line and the green lines are best offer and best bid, or best ask and best bid offered by the market makers. So other market makers might offer worse prices.
So I don't understand. Why you call these parasites? If I want to buy, I want a better quote. So if they're making a better quote, I'm happy. So I like that guy.
Yes.
He's not a parasite to me. So why do you call this a parasite?
Because in our simulation, there is a fairly large difference between people, market makers, who offer liquidity. So for example, they just place the orders based, say, on some quantitative parameter. For example, how many orders they received before. Or they could be looking at the market and seeing that if I undercut by, say, 1/10, 1/8, 1/16, or 1 penny, whether I can maybe complete a round trip transaction and jump out of the market and then wait until conditions are right again. And so such a strategy would not provide much liquidity in our simulation, but actually can affect the prices. As Mike pointed out, there is not necessarily a very sharp quantitative difference between parasitic strategies and non-parasitic ones. But we make such a distinction because those strategies exist in the simulation, in the actually real world. And in our conversations with market makers, we did a number of interviews. Some of them would say that this is what I'm doing. But we can talk about it later. So what happens here is investor sees the blue line, which is the price at which they can buy security from the market makers. And they see the green line, the price at which they can sell security to the market makers. And then they compare it with the actual price, and then they decide whether they do a transaction. So those blue dots are transactions which happen here. And so what we call a parasitic strategy is the strategy which, for example, here, it says that the bid is pretty low. So maybe, but they may have an expectation that the market is going even lower pretty fast. So they may just try undercut here and then not provide liquidity for a while and then get out of the market either at the same time step or the next few time steps. This is the structure of the simulation. So market makers and investors interact through, let's call it exchange, through a centralized mechanism on which market makers post their quotes and on which investors can accept those quotes. We also incorporated limit orders and limit order books and ECNs into our simulation. ECN is an electronic communication network, and it gives capabilities to the investors instead of going through the broker, do it at least in some way more directly by placing the orders themselves. And also, we have some structures for storing the data. So, in this model, we could trade in market orders. That's where investors simply says, give me the best price. I want to buy, give me the best price you can give me. We could trade in limit orders, in where investor says, I want to buy at price X, let's say 10. And There is also a possibility to negotiate, but it's mainly between market makers in this simulation. So some of the rules we have is order handling rules, for example, which orders take priorities. And also our simulation respects the tick sizes. So investors cannot submit in between currently lowest tick size. I mean, the price increments with currently lowest tick size. I mean, market makers cannot move the price by moving that. And so modes of interactions in our simulation include quote montage or exchange, where the orders are posted, the quotes are posted. And also we have ECNs and limit order books, but those are for market makers internal processing of different orders they have received but have not executed. It's also possible to have this preferential relationship between certain entities, but I'm not going to cover this. So the calibrated model to two parameters. One of them is two global objectives, actually. One of them is that to ensure that the behaviors of our actual investors and market makers match, or to some degree at least, those observed in the real world, and also that they could replicate the simulated strategies can actually replicate what was done by the real world strategies. And we also used created a software just to automate this process. And
when you say replicated the real world strategies, are you just comparing order placement? Are you saying that your simulated strategies were actually placing orders at the same time?
Actually,
as a real stream of orders, or how do you see that?
I'm actually talking about market making strategies. And so there we actually received from NASDAQ after we sent a very large number of documents, some data on the actual trades. Wow. And so we knew who executed, which market maker executed the trade. And so this is where Mike was talking about that we could explain a lot with just a few strategies. And that's maybe a cognitive bias in us humans, but we tend to think that we're extremely sophisticated. But when we start to look at actual orders executed, say, by a particular market maker, then you may be able to explain a large fraction of them by just simply assuming that market maker is following a very simple rule, just.
I understand this, the parasitic, what you might call a parasitic strategy versus something else. There's a big store. People can go in.
Yeah.
They can see all the products in the store. They can maybe try on the things. And I open a little store right next door that has a lower price, and they can't come in and try things. So I go to the big store. I try on. I get my size. I get my choice. And then I go out the door into the, call it the parasitic store, where you, and I run much cheaper because there's no rooms to try. That's what you were, is that the intuition?
I guess it's something like this.
No, but there's no analogy to the not trying on part, because those guys are posting quotes like everybody
else.
Yes,
here it is for real.
And
then what is the difference?
And even if, you know, you can effectively have a parasitic strategy, even if you're posting bids and offers, you can always make one of your bids or offers ridiculous. You know, make it way out of the park, and then when you want to do something, you bring it back in.
Right.
So just posting bids and offers is not sufficient. So I'm worried it's members of the exchange versus not members of the exchange. Is that the distinction?
Look, the parasitic was a provocative adjective. And if you have, with the benefit of hindsight, if you look back on a market now in which the basic, you know, smoothed out and yield share prices have come to bear little if any resemblance to anything happening in the underlying companies that they represent. And you know, have a market where qualitatively, when you look at it, it's easy to say that this thing's trading on trading more than it's trading on fundamentals. Whenever you call that coupling coefficient or whatever it is, gets too stretched out. We're looking for categories of people that stretch it, and we're away from fundamentals, and we're looking for categories of people that move it back towards fundamentals, and a more neutral academic descriptor would have been less provocative.
What about technical trading? What you just described sounds like the difference between technical and fundamental traders, people who follow the markets and price trends.
The taxonomy is terminologically charged, and it causes people who are doing these things and feel good about it to be angry. But it was also the term now, toxic trader, and toxic trades and parasitic trading is so popular in the vocabulary of Wall Street, and the amount of people worried about it is so much greater than it was back then, that it was adjectivally predictive by luck, and it was probably not a very good scientific term to use. We probably would have said something.
If you looked at foreign exchange trading, right, where you had banks dominating the market making function, you have all this language like speed bumps, last look, dirty business, and it was initially very confusing to me to come into this, because everything that I thought made for efficient markets had this incredibly pejorative label, because there was a transition in that market. What? Right, right. So the point is that efficient markets had acquired all of this negative stigma, and it took me a while to realize it was exactly the reverse.
Yes, I have just a few more slides, so let's finish them and then have a discussion. Okay, thank you. Okay, so those are the questions which we investigated. The main one is the effects of tick size reductions. But the rest of the questions actually came more like afterthought. We didn't even thought about them before, but after we built the simulations and after we've got our initial results, we decided that it would be good to compare the simulation to other things which happen in the real world. We don't know if it happens in the simulation or not, but at least we could compare it to what happens in the real world, and if it does, then it's an indication that maybe something is right, and if it doesn't, then it's otherwise. And we also added some learning and evolution. So those are our tick size results. This is the standard deviation of the price from this target price of the security, and we at some point called it true value early on in the project. And so here, the difference. Maybe I should start with this slide. So,
is true value fundamental value?
Yes, yes.
And how do you get
that? That's externally generated in the simulation. That's what when I was talking about this log normal book or Poisson processing. So, let's start with this slide. So, this target value is the. On my screen, it looks like a. Green line, and I guess here it's also green. And the bid and ask spread is this sort of combination of red and yellow lines. And so with the small tick size, what we see is the bids and offers, and actually the transactions, are following the target price, or what we call true value, quite closely. But when we reduce the tick size to 100, this there is a fairly large deviation between them. And so what I quantified in the previous slide is this delta between mean bid ask and the target price. So this is what we see here. So if the tick size is very large, in this case, not surprisingly, you have fairly large difference between the target price and the mean bid ask spread, mean bid ask, and if the tick size is very small, that was a surprising result. Here you have fairly large difference, and all this is for a simulation where we have the parasitic strategies. That's why they're actually so important here, but also in the real world. And so what we found out that there is, in our simulation, a particular tick size on which this distance is minimized. And so if you don't have parasitic strategies, then nothing really, the tick size doesn't really matter. The market is pretty good at discovering the target price. So. And so some of our additional results, they are just simply to see if what happens in the real world happens in our simulation. So there is this, we talked a lot about the fat tails. So the origins are, I believe, are still uncertain. And so the question for us was whether those fat tails happen in our simulation. So for example, we could start with a log normally distributed target price, but then our price, actual price dynamics would be distributed with, would be much narrower on the inside and would be distributed with fairly large tails on the outside. And so that's without doing anything to the agents to induce the fat tails. It just simply comes as a result of the dynamics. And this result is fairly robust in presence of various strategies. And what's interesting, if we take the observations farther apart, so instead of looking at the changes in the log prices from one tick to another, well, from one time step to another, we look at 50 periods here, then the fat tails more or less distributed, the distribution of the returns actually concentrates in the middle. And we have some explanations, but they are still somewhat tentative because, so one of the possibilities why it happens is because of interaction and also self-interaction through the price dynamics. Because if you do something, then you not only affect the market, but you also affect what you will think on the market in the next time step and all the transactions you would be able to make. But also, we think that spread, existence of the spread is also a contributing factor and also memory of traders and investors. And we don't have any sort of explicit herd effects here. So spread clustering was another thing which I decided to look at. And so it was observed in academic literature by Christian Schultz that market makers prefer, I believe it was even quotes. And that's actually leads to spread clustering. We looked at a slightly different phenomenon, but if market makers cluster on a particular, let's say, even price increments, that would give you spread clustering in the actual data and also in the simulation. So we decided to look if we can have the spread clustering in our simulation, and indeed it did happen. So the spread was not really uniformly distributed, but it had some peaks. This is, result is also interesting because it depends actually on the population of strategies. So there are certain kinds of strategies to which it will not occur, but the ones which approximate real world better, it actually does happen in the simulation. And so this is an emergent property in our simulation, and it's also a very important property, I believe, still for the real world, because it does occur in a number of markets like NASDAQ, and also it occurs Forex, but apparently it's there, it's considered to be completely fine to cluster the plots. So we also have learning in the simulation, but I will not go into it except that it's fairly effective. Another interesting thing we discovered here, and that is, this is actually based on the data analysis of the previous tick size reduction from 1/8 to 1/16, which happened back in 1997. So we have data from 1997. And here what we did, we calibrated our simulation to 2 months, May 1997 and June 1997. So in the simulation, we have a number of investors and market makers, the calibrated market maker strategies. And so we have a classes of, let's say for a particular stock, we identified 15 market maker strategies. So in this case, we would have parameters of those strategies and we would have traits for those strategies. So what we did here, we tried to see if we can explain what market maker is doing by not using our approximation of the strategy, but by using just a simple regression. We started actually with 30 parameters, but then we realized that we can reduce it almost to just two independent variables, and that is the what two representative market makers, the ones which are fairly orthogonal to each other, actually doing. And so in this case, it's possible to then, if you have two representative strategies, then you have two coefficients if you run regression of what particular market maker is doing on the actions of the two other market makers. And so what we observed here, that there are, in the real world, with our using real world data and then using our calibrated strategies, there was a fundamental shift in the strategies used by the market makers in before and after the previous calibration. So that's also makes you think that there could be also a fundamental shift then potentially unpredictable one, at least some details of it, for the next round of decimal. Ah, those are just those two coefficients. So the, I'm not sure how well it's visible here. The blue dot is just the representation of each market making strategy by a combination of two base agent market making strategies. And so. Ah, it's alpha and beta. Yes. It's, we said that a market maker strategy can be explained. We started with 30 alphas, betas, and whatever. But we, later on, we realized that a market maker strategy can be explained, at least in the simulation, fairly well with just two representative market makers. And so then you run linear regression of what these market makers did on what those two market makers did. And that's what gives you alpha and beta. The crucial thing here is that there is just a straight blue line for May, but for June you have two lines, red lines going on here. So that means that there is a phase shift in the strategies used by the market makers here. And those strategies actually calibrated from real data. Of course, there is an error involved. I'm sorry. So this is the summary of our findings. So finally, I arrived. So decimalization, we predicted that decimalization will negatively affect the price discovery. And we also predicted that there would be ambiguous wealth effects by the investors. That actually was one of the main drivers for decimalization, that if the spread is lower, that means that investors should pay less for executing the transactions. So in a way, there should be more wealth going to the investors as a result of it. But that's not what we predicted. That we also predicted that phase transitions will occur in the space of market maker strategies, and that spread clustering may become more frequent with tick size reductions. We also predicted that parasitic strategies would become more prevalent with the tick size reductions. And our last prediction was that the volume will increase potentially from 15 to 600%. Here, we didn't have a good prediction, so that's why we have such a broad range. So actual decimalization happened, started in March of 2001. It was fully completed, or most of it was completed in April of 2001. NASDAQ economists actually captured the data from before and after the decimalization and wrote an extensive report of its results. So what we did, we compared our findings with the what was in mainly in the NASDAQ findings. So what we find that we found a significant support for five of our six predictions. And there wasn't really, at that time when the decimalization happened, the market was in a, going down, so the volumes were also not going up. So so it's not necessarily that, so there were other factors which changed before and after, but that also applies to some of those things in the
I don't see how you could ever test one, because you don't know what the actual fundamental price is.
Yes, you don't. And so one of the way our logic is going here is that, so in our simulation, we have these reductions in market's ability to discover the target price of the security. So the question is, what are the implications of that? And so one of them, in the real world, what supports this particular first, the first one you're talking about,
yeah,
is the fact that actual depths, for example, of quotes for a number of stocks actually decreased. Mm-hmm. And that probably does not lead to better price discovery. So even though it's hard to quantify, at least there is this some actually quantitative support for that assertion. And
well, but I just regard reduction of depth as a completely, I mean,
yes,
it might involve meaning what you say, or might mean something else. I mean, I don't think it's implications about discovery of a correct price are not obvious.
Let me give you some situational color, because we're talking about 12-year-old stuff here.
to make sure we know what the words mean. There was a company at this time that was heavily supported by all the sell side firms called Optimark that was bringing to the market a new idea for a way to let the long only guys who had a target price in mind for the company based on evaluation of fundamental things. And Optimark's idea was that the traders would be better off if they, instead of matching specific bids and asks, if they went into a vault where you couldn't see what things were and shared preference curves. Because, you know, any trader would know, you know, that the size of his order would affect the price. And so, you know, he'd live on some kind of a preference curve where this he'd be happy with this price at this volume and a different price at a different volume. And that that company went broke. In part, I think, because they were arrogant, because when they went at the actual trading floor and tried to lecture these alpha traders down there who throw their phones at one another and are, you know, intuitive and you know, type A and jack to the nines, wouldn't have anything to do with fiddling around being lectured to about what a preference is. They knew what their own preferences were, and they didn't want any scientific advice. And what we did in response to that, I did two things. I invested in Optimark to make so in case it worked out, I was covered. And then I started a company called Pipeline in case it didn't work out, so there would be a better solution. And Pipeline's still alive and well. Pipeline is the one that does the algorithmic prophylaxis and is much more flexible about letting the traders do whatever they want and makes it very simple to interact. So that's kind of the setting in which this happened. So what we were saying effectively in that setting at that time in history when we said target price was that we had a lot of evidence that, you know, if we went and talked to the long-only guys, they would tell us they had a preference curve. If we tried to get in between the long-only guys and the trading desks, the traders would say, take your preference curve and shove it. Don't tell us what to do down here on the trading floor. So when we target price means that, you know, we had some evidence that the long-only investors did have some thought about what they thought was the fundamental price in their judgment. They didn't all have the same one, you know, which is what you'd expect, but they had thought that way. And since, you know, if we were to do this work today, it'd be completely different. These models don't live forever. You know, they live in a point in history, the ones who are doing make a business decision with. They live at a time, at a point in history, based on the way people are thinking about things at that time, and, you know, they evolve.
Did anybody at that time anticipate the incredible proliferation of black liquidity pools and the explosion of volume and the decline in order size, which has just been unbelievable?
Not
the average order size now, I think, on New York Stock Exchange stocks is about 100 shares and dropping.
Right. But the average order size in the reported data may mask the block trading that drives it because the block traders bust up their trades.
That's my point.
Bunch of little things.
No, that's so my point. That's right. Exactly my point.
I have just one more slide, so let's finish it.
One more.
So, and I have, your attention is something much more extensive on the calibration, on the validation, so I can give this to you. There are other things like whether you can execute the order on the inside, on the outside, which also, I believe, could be indicative of the price discovery, but just as you say, they are only an indication, not necessarily a direct causal lead. And for the ambiguous wealth effects, the market was broken at that time, so we cannot really take effect, credit here either. But we don't even want to. But they indeed were ambiguous. It's phase transitions, it was clear after the decimalization that the market has changed dramatically, and many market makers had to change their trading strategy, so there's no ambiguity that there was a phase transition there. And spread clustering is actually supported by what NASDAQ reported in their report, and it probably is available, but I have quotes for it as well. So the last, we also published a book on this project. It was published 2 years ago, and by World Scientific Press, and it's available on Amazon. But I wanted to say my deepest thanks to Mike, because without him, without his help, support, and encouragement, neither the book nor the project would be possible. That's all I have. I had some other slides, but I think.
Thank you so much. Why don't we have 5 minutes of discussion and then we'll break for coffee? Go ahead.
I was going to answer Bill's question with Goodwin, I think, not to the benefit of retrospect to claim too much prescience. There's been a steady trend of fragmentation in liquidity pools. The ECNs that Sasha mentioned were one example of that. There were liquidity pools upstairs in all the sell side firms because they don't, you know, if they can trade inside their own clients, they don't need cash to clear, so it's sort of a form of liquidity, non-cash liquidity. Since this was done, that little phase transition indicator slide that he showed, you know, had we been deeper and more thoughtful about it at the time, should have been taken more seriously than it was. We've now had an explosion of liquidity pools, so if you're looking for liquidity in the market now versus here, and here versus before that, the branching has just exploded. So this is a point in history a decade ago. It would be a much different story if we were to try to model it today. It'd be harder to model today than it was then by a bunch.
Yeah, it's actually a very interesting question as to what the hell best price means. Best price where, when, et cetera.
So perhaps this is exactly the way to restore the analogy with the big retail store with the convenience of trying and so on. The enormous advantages of having depth in the order book, both for risk management and hedging and so on. I want to go to the market and I want to have liquidity and I want to know that if I'm buying 1, 2, 10, 20, 50 of the shares that are quoted, I'm going to pay the same price. So yeah, I don't want to have preferences that constantly tell me that immediately if I change the quantity, there's going to change in price. And that's what the large non-parasitic market makers are doing. They're providing that liquidity. And that's the analog of the convenience of the big
store. That's true.
But then, as you were saying, the effect is to increase the profitability of the parasitic traders, and then it reduces the depth of the order book in the end.
Yes, that's actually a fiduciary duty for all the market makers to provide liquidity. But the degree to which you can do that is there is a large variability in that.
Yeah. And that's why there's no clear-cut distinction of the parasitic
Let me just respond to that. Because I've lived both. I just want to answer his question because I think it's a big question. Because I've lived in both worlds, and if I'm trading, I would like to be a parasite. And if I'm and I like things fast, and I like more liquidity, and everything about this balance on the finance side aimed at liquidity, I like. If I'm over on the other side, which is the company underneath, keep in mind the whole social reason that we have this. It's because if you're a company with a long cycle time, like you make a drug, it takes 10 years, or maybe you're trying to invent new energy that might take 20 years, or maybe you're trying to do these things to provide goods and services that are important in the broader ecosystem. What you like about it is that the capital is stable and very long. What's good about it over on the other side is that that a system can provide long capital stable at the same time that it lets individual guys get in and out of the stock and have some liquidity. If you get this system out of balance too far in either direction, you have a problem. But when you look at it from the outside, you've got to be careful. If you're in one space or the other, you're a rat in the maze. If you want to wear a lab coat and look at the maze and think about all the rats in a balanced way, then you've got to make this mental jump and going, I know I'm a rat and I could be in there, but I'm going to imagine I'm not and then try to understand all the rats in the maze.
I'm entirely with you.
Okay.
Let's take one last question and then let's break for coffee.
We've studied empirically what the effect of tick size is on various things, and we have not seen any difference in heavy tails in prices, which surprised us because we do see effects. You know, if we look at the tail exponent, we do see an effect due to volume. We see an effect due to volatility in the way you would think it would go, meaning less volume means lower values of the alpha, which means more extreme risks. A higher volatility also means that same thing, but to our surprise, we didn't see any effect with tick size.
Towards which variable I'm sorry?
Tick size.
No.
How do we measure tick size?
No. Effects on which variable?
Effects on heavy tails. As we looked at the price changes, tick by tick price changes, as well as time changes on like minute and 5 minutes and so on, and we don't see any effect on the tail exponent characterizing the heaviness of the tail. Mm-hmm. That's conditioned on tick size.
When?
We looked in London stock market data for across about 3 years, and we looked at a bunch of New York Stock Exchange data. We don't have NASDAQ data.
This is back in the 90s?
Well, no, we actually looked at a New York Stock Exchange data set with spanning eighths, sixteenths, and pennies. And so we've got a couple of years of each. And we looked at 50 stocks, And we didn't see an effect.
Hard comparison because the structures are so different. You know, specialists, multiple market makers.
Different. Yeah, so it could be that it has to do with some other microstructure effect that happens in the NASDAQ, but not in what we're.
But the fat tails, which I was presenting here, they were an illustration that they happen in the simulation.
Well, the simulation they do. I'm just saying the real data.
Yes.
We didn't see that. We didn't see the real data.
You mean you didn't see fat tails at all in the real data?
No, there are fat tails in the real data, but tick size does not affect how fat they are.
Yes, but I wasn't saying that it does.
Okay, then I didn't understand that. Sorry, I thought you said that when you shrunk the tick size, that increased the fatness of the tails. I must have misunderstood then.
The point was, if I could live life over again, I would have done this 3 years earlier before I paid the settlement with the SEC for all of our guys being crooks because there was a fat tail in between the bid and ask, and I'd have tried to get it in federal court instead of the agency, and I might have won, and this model might have had its day in the sunshine. That would have been an even simpler business purpose because all I would have had to do is duplicate the fat tail without any rules that allowed collusion. But, we didn't have enough sense to do that at the time. We did this when we did do it, and it was just kind of a nail in the coffin of this having any use for political decision making, because the court had already held that the trades didn't go off at the midpoint. It was prima facie evidence of collusion, so you were now guilty until proven innocent in a system which produced this mechanically, regardless of what you did.
Doing, are you talking about fat tails or spread clustering?
No, I was referring to fat tails.
Because spread clustering does occur in our simulation and after that simulation.
So if I understand this correct, it doesn't have to be collusion.
It doesn't
have to be herding, but you still get the fat tails.
Collusion, that's in relation to spread clustering. Collusion doesn't really, at least in our analysis, doesn't factor into fat tails.
So you don't need any motivation or even implicit herding going on.
We don't have explicit herding. There may be some implicit herding just because if a certain set of strategies are doing the same thing.
Why don't we continue this over coffee if we'd like, and why don't we meet back here at 1:45?
Thanks, Asha. Good job.
Going back.